Accession number 13359, Mr. George Richardson, Reel 16.
Mr. G.S. Richardson, Reel 16. You'd come out of some quite severe fighting by now, Mr. Richardson.
Yes.
Were you beginning to feel tired at all?
Well, we'd had Olive and we'd had a little bit of fun in around Alexandria, and we had the satisfaction of having done a grand job up the desert, and we thought we'd just about had enough fighting, and we thought, well, it's about time that somebody else did, so we weren't the only regiment and fighting unit in there.
Did you find it
army.
More difficult to face actions and danger as time went on, from the point of view that probably you feel I'm a bit hit sometimes?
Well, yes. I knew that as the original platoon and the original battalion, and we're getting less and less and less. We'll keep getting reinforced by different people, but our few, I knew that my odds of survival were getting down, 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 and so on. I was going to cop something, and that was something that never happened. But I never had that, I never dwelt on them things. I tried to keep up a regular correspondence back home to, I used to like letters. I've always been a keen letter writer, and I had quite a few different correspondents that I just tried to keep my morale up by thinking of home and what was going to happen when it was all over. Because I felt after Alamein that we couldn't lose the war. I knew that the Germans were suffering defeat in but through the Russians, and we were already doing well towards going into Europe. But when that would happen, I had no idea.
Was there much feeling of patriotism as being part of the reasons why you're fighting?
No. I don't suppose, although I have been a strong patriot and a royalist, if you want to put it that way. I've always been regimental in most things I've done, even through my work time. And ever since I came out of the army, I've always been more or less used to discipline in one way or another. So I've done quite a lot of discipline in my lifetime, both in work and after work when I was became a member of St. John Ambulance.
So discipline is the important element.
Well, I would say so, yes. Yes, and I think that we fought hard and we like to play hard. That's the way I saw it. When we got the chance, we did. But I've never been the one that went out and got drunk. I've never been one to go run left to win for the sake of running left arm. So
you were back in the canal zone. What kind of training were you now faced with?
Yes, we had entirely different training up to then. We'd been desert fighting. We'd learned a bit house-to-house fighting when we were up in Benghazi. We hadn't had any house-to-house fighting in Tunisia. We'd had one or two hard battles up in Tunisia, but nothing quite as big as the Alamein battle, but lost quite a few men. But now our training became training to run about on ships. Our infantry were sent out to clamber up and down the side of ships and in and out of landing craft on the saltwater lakes in the middle of the Suez Canal. I was sent on a 2-week course with the Royal Navy. myself another signaler, and this was to learn naval signaling and their way of talking. We had a way of talking in the army that was a bit different to the way we talked over the radio in the Navy. So we had to learn some naval terms. I lived in what do you call them? Not petty officers' mess. The ones that have a hook on. What's their rank? They were equivalent to a sergeant. We messed with them, and we even went on a couple of pay parades to get our weekly pay, same time as them, and learned to receive pay different, although we did exactly what we've been trained, because we knew no other, and of course the naval officer that gave us our pay did exactly what I suppose he knew that we were going to do, whereas the Navy off huts, they hand the pay into the huts, they step back, take a pay out and on huts, but we go up, salute, step forward to the desk, sign, pick up our money, step back, salute, about turn and go. But maybe do it different. We learned to do some recognition of flag signals that they send between ships. I was training with some Royal Navy Commandos. We had a Royal Navy Commando gunnery officer that used to come and talk about gunnery commands from ship to shore. And I later joined up with him again. But for 2 weeks, I was all intents a Royal Navy signaler, learning their way of going on. And then we rejoined the battalion. They had been doing a heck of a lot of running out of ships and sailing about on the saltwater lakes, freshwater lakes, is it? And then we were taken down to Port Suez.
Had you any idea at this stage where you were going?
No. When we arrived down at Port Suez, there were some large mountains on the side. There's quite a lot of troops that had never been in action. A New Zealand camp that hadn't been long in the desert. We used to go and visit them. We could buy whiskey and gin and stuff like that from them. That we weren't allowed to buy now. There's only sergeants and officers that were allowed spirits. But we were allowed to go, and we did. Our troops were mountaineering up and down these high mountains. Each day they set out and climbed 200 or 300 yards up the mountain and full equipment. We had to go up and down with wirelesses, and there was quite a few of our men slipped and hurt themselves. I think there was at least a couple of them killed themselves coming down the side of the mountain with loaded up with 200 rounds of ammunition, and nothing was to stop them. We weren't roped together or anything like that, we were just climbing over rocks. We wondered what we were going to do. We knew that was something entirely different to what we had been doing. Then the harbour started filling up with ships, all kinds of ships, transporters and some beautiful cruisers, Royal Navy ships. Then we were told that we were going on a cruise to be both an exercise and also a rest. They took us out and we went on to the Winchester Castle, a beautiful ship, being a Union Castle line, sailed from Southampton down to South Africa on its regular peacetime service. It was a really fast ship, and we were allocated to come into a cabin, our own toilet and running water inside the cabin, comfortable bunks. We didn't have any bunk service, cabin service. We had to go to mess decks for feeding. I noticed that the first day we called up on boat drill, instead of having lifeboats on the davits, they were all slung with these huge Landing Craft Assault, LCAs, as we call them, All the davits were loaded with these, and instead of being back, they were hanging over the side of the ship. They're too big to pull inboard. And we had two stations to go to. Lifeboat drill, we had one allocation when we went up with just our life jackets on. And the other station was a different sound and hooter entirely. And we had to go up just for action and assemble outside of our allocated boats. And then the captain and the brigadier or CO would come around, inspect everybody so that everybody was in position, and then the bugle would sound stand down, and the rest of the day was free. That was more or less what we're doing, and we're sailing down the Red Sea. We had no idea where we were going, but we went for a 10-day cruise, and we could, one day we would look out and see the African coast, the other day we would look out and see the Saudi Arabian coast. Then we were told that we were going on a shore landing on the side of the Arabian coast. And the next morning, I think, around about 6 o'clock, we were called to stations and we all assembled, and this Royal Marine officer that had been with me back up in the Royal Naval Station, and four Royal Marine signalers with him, were in the same boat as I was. Our boat were carrying nondescripts. It was under the command of this commando captain. Most of the men had been put there as reserves to companies, not attached to any company. And I wondered what my job was. All I knew that I was going ashore with this naval commando. But, and that's the way we did when we went ashore on the exercise. I went ashore with this Royal Naval Commando officer. He took me in with his signalers. So his signalers had two sets, I had one. My job was to keep in contact with our battalion headquarters and send messages, either give messages to the commando officer or messages from the commando officer back to our battalion headquarters. We did this exercise and spent the whole day getting everybody ashore. We advanced. We were firing live from Royal Navy ships into the desert. We firing live rounds as we went forward. The forward troops were advancing and they'd set targets up. Looked like machine gun position. There was tons of explosions going off and they were throwing firecrackers around. And quite lively action. And when we're all settled and dug in position where we're all at the position, we just lay around. Montgomery came ashore, walked around a lot of us, and looked around with the rest of the brigadiers and said, all right, that's quite satisfactory. Back to the ships. And we went back to the ships and spent a few more days living a life of luxury, actually, for that 10 days. We were well fed and really luxury cruise, just swanning about in the Red Sea. As good as anything I've paid for ever since. We came back to Suez and went ashore again for about another week. In that wake, were maulers just checking over our equipment and shipping all our transport, guns and everything onto the transporters in the harbour. And then they took us aboard, same ship, Winchester Castle. I went to the same cabin, but instead of and signalling myself, we had one of the brigade staff coming in, one of the brigade privates, pushed in our cabin, so that we had all our 6th Battalion plus brigade staff on the Winchester Castle. And we set sail, and instead of going down the Red Sea, we went through the canal. And all the way through the canal, troops that had come down from Tunisia and back to the base for leave, they're all shouting, "Lucky buggers on the road back to Blighty," because there's a huge convoy going through, all kinds of warships and transporters, you know. We got to port side and docked. I and another signaller, leg swimming, we found that there was a port door open about 15 foot above the water. So he says, "Have I gone for a swim?" So I put our big D trunks on. I says, "How are we going to get back?" He says, "Oh," he says, "I've been up to the aft end. I've got a rope ladder over." So I says, "Right there." So it was a bit too high to dive for me, so I jumped in. I think I went down about 20 foot before I bobbed back to the surface again. And swimming to the aft end was quite a long swim along the side of the ship, because I hadn't done any swim for a long while. And I thought, I'm never going to get to the aft end. Anyway, I got to the aft end, and all the seamen were over having a swim in the harbour. Been in about half an hour, when I saw this army bloke with his cork life jacket coming down the rope ladder. He got down about 10 foot from the rope ladder and jumped into the water. I watched him do this, and he was about 10 foot from the side of the ship, and he says, "Hey mister, give us a push to the rope ladder." I said, "Well, swim." He said, "I can't swim." I said, "What the hell are you doing in here? It's about 90 foot deep." He says, "I don't know if this cork life jacket worked." I said, "What about if it hadn't?" He says, "Never thought of that." So I pushed him over the ladder, and he clambered up, and we followed him up and found our way back to our own decks. But at the end of the ship, I suppose we had a bouncer, but we got back on without much trouble. Then 2 days in Portside, and then we set sail. Lovely morning, and we sailed out into the sunlight, into the Mediterranean. Assembled on deck about 10 o'clock. We had been called to the open deck, and Brigadier Commanding Officer Sammy Watson and all our officers up, they had all been issued with boxes, 24-hour ration packs, and booklets. So we all sat in platoons, and our platoon officers came and handed us a book, and then one platoon each got a box and had to pass around a box open, and showed us what rations were inside. And I think it was a brigadier, I said, "Well, you wonder what where we're off to now. I can tell you now, it was sailing out in the Mediterranean. We're going down to invade Sicily. If you open the first page of your book, you'll find a map of Sicily. And on the bottom, you'll find a little place called Avola. And that's where we're going to land."
What date was this?
Oh, no idea. Yes. Well, as we were sailing down, the convoy was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And
what date was this?
Around about the 6th of July, 1943. All the way down the Med, we were joined up with all kinds of transporters.
What were you doing on board ship now? You knew where you were going. Were you being shown maps,
yes,
models?
We were taking up most mornings. We were given map references where we had to land. They were showing aerial maps, gun emplacements. This applied mostly to the troops. We had all our weapons with us, whereas on the first ship that we'd gone on, we hadn't been allowed our weapons on the first transport. But on this one, we were fully armed, and we had to get our weapons oiled and all our signal equipment. We had all checked over, all our wirelesses were checked, new batteries, spare batteries carried in our packs, and we were living a fairly good life sailing down the Mediterranean.
Had there been any changes to your radio sets? Were they any better?
Oh, it was a better set than, I think it was a 21 that we were carrying now. It was the 18, but I think it was a 21 then. It was had a longer range, 5 or 6 miles easy, whereas the previous range, we were looking to get 3 miles with full aerials.
But how did it work, this particular set?
Well, we had a handset, and the top half was a transmitter, the bottom half was a receiver. We would press the handset to speak, release the handset to receive. And of course, it was always over before we did either to speak. And of course, we always spoke in the technique that we learned as wireless signalers in our lessons that we'd taught how to receive and transmit messages by radio. We never yet sent or received messages by Morse, although there was a Morse key on the 18 set. But there was too much interference to really receive. Although, and I remember when we were training in on Dartmoor, we did manage to receive over about 5 mile range by Morse key, where we couldn't do it by radio telephony. Telegraphy. We could do it by WTOC. Our board drill each day after that was continuously going, not for board drill for abandoned ship, but for going to our allocated stations for disembarkation in our landing craft. And the same personnel were with us every time. Same personnel being allocated. I'm not sure, I think I was a number 11 on the davits. And then the final morning came. The Royal Air Force had been flying over during the night. We'd seen quite a lot of action with them. And in the morning, daylight came, and there was cruisers and gunboats firing into the shore, and in the distance we could see the shores of Sicily. They put us into a landing craft about 9 miles from land. It was very rough. The Germans had actually stood down because the Mediterranean was so rough and they didn't expect any invasion to come in. The two smaller islands had already been captured below Sicily by other troops.
What do you recall of that journey into the shore?
Yes, well, we had two Royal Navy in charge of the ship, an engineer and a steersman, I forget the ranks, and we had a rum ration of two large bottles of rum passed down each side, about 30 miles per hour ship with our Royal Marine Captain in charge, and I was at the end, the rear end of the ship with his four signalers, the K2 wirelesses, and himself. We swanned about a bit. After I'd had my rum ration, I'd had more than a normal run ration, and for the first time in life I was sick. I wouldn't say it was seasickness, it was just my stomach heaving up and down with rum. And so I got rid of that. And
were you given anything to take seasickness?
No.
Or yet. Just sick into the boat?
We had sick bags. Oh yes, paper bags that we used. I carry them on aircraft now, but I never had to use them. We vomited into bags, and most of the, even the Royal Navy. Were thrown up because it was really rough. The ship was bouncing about. We saw quite a lot of our ships hitting the beaches, and Royal Navy Marine officer, rather not the Royal Navy officer, Royal Marine officer, picked his spot and then told the to stay for that spot, and we went in, and we didn't see any immediate action. The beaches more or less deserted where we went in, but just a bit further up there was some real action going on. I know there's one company commander just run out in front of his troops and they're mainly killed with a burst of machine gun fire, but on the whole the Vola beaches were captured with very little trouble. There was one lad's gun firing down under the beachhead from the hills. And this is where I saw the use of the Royal Marine. I was in command of sending messages from him to our battalion, and our battalion order was that they were being hit by this large gun and could we do anything about it. So the gunnery officer had a little handset, which I thought he was carrying, I thought it was just a small briefcase or even a cigar box. That's what it looked like to me. But he took a bearing at the gun flash. He walked 100 yards along the beach and took another bearing and worked out the trigonometrical ratio. Spoke through his handset to through his box to a gunship. The gunship opened up with full broadsides, and we could hear the shells screaming down over the head, and that gun never opened fire again. You could see the trees around about that, some 5 or 6 miles inland, just the trees were just collapsing, and the gun never opened up again.
So you were the communication between your own battalion commander and this.
And this
naval observation.
That's right. And we just wound up and down the beach looking for targets, but that was the only main target he did. He was getting other messages through his other sets to the gunnery ships and the commander of the fleet that he was part of, and he was sending some sightings into in front of our troops. Just in front of our positions, some gliders had come in with American troops. And on the first night, after a volley, we found some of these Americans, and one of our patrols had come across some Italians throwing grenades at one of the Americans strung up in the tree on a ice parachute, and they're throwing grenades at them, so the more they're locked down. I was told to report back to battalion headquarters more or less at the end of that day, and I took the rest of the infantry with me, and those infantry were dispatched to companies that needed extra men for replacements.
Was there much sign of severe fighting on the beaches?
Not where I landed, but there had been some. There was quite a few casualties, but I don't think a lot by overturning in the first instant. We quickly moved in on Cap de Vola, and I was sent in to look for a route to lay cables out to one of our forward companies. I went through Evola with Vance Copperweir, and there was somebody that looked like a town official came up to Joe Weir and talking in broken Italian English, and Joe followed them to this local council offices, and there was a jail. Apparently he must have been a council official, and he wanted to hand over the keys of the village to him, who was the most senior officer of the team. He was only Lance Corporal. So Joe got his keys and he said, "What the for?" And he looked and he pointed and he tried it, and it opened his jail full of blokes, and all the blokes came out and were kissing him, and you know, God only knows what they'd done, but inside there, and they let them pay.